Number 31, doesn't seem like it's been 31 sermons ago that we started in the story of David. Maybe you think it does feel like it was that many and more. If so, just keep it to yourself. I don't want to hear about it. But we're not so far from the end as we are closing out the book of 2 Samuel. And David has just a few more chapters for us to cover. Tonight, as we look at chapter 18, the subject is victory and grief. We've kind of left the scene with some urgent things taking place. David has fled from the city of Jerusalem because Absalom, his son, has mustered an army, has convinced the men of Israel to join his side, and Absalom would be king. He wants to be the king over God's people. David has fled. We ended the last discussion with David going to the city of Mahanaim, which was on the east side of the River Jordan, a city that you may remember Abner had chosen to install or to place Ishbosheth, as the king over the northern portion of God's people right after the death of Saul. That's where we were first introduced, at least in this story, to that city of Mahanaim. It is there that David has taken refuge. Absalom is on the way there. In the last chapter, near the end of the chapter, it says that Absalom and his army crossed over the river, which means they crossed in an easterly direction, northeastern direction, headed toward where David was, convinced that David would be sitting there just waiting for them to come and attack him and take all of those people prisoner who were with David and kill David, and everything then would be settled. That's not exactly the way David saw his battle plan. David did not choose to be a sitting duck with his army. We don't know the exact size of David's army, but the opening verses of chapter 18 say that David numbered the people who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. Just by that wording, we're given an indication that there were no 10,000s, no 100,000s. There were only thousands and hundreds. Josephus, in his writing and commentary that was recorded just shortly after the time of the life of Christ, says that David probably had an army of 4,000 men. I suppose that would be a fair number, given what we know about the situation of all of the host of Israel. 4,000 were able to be gathered together and taken along on David's side. We also don't know how many Absalom had. Commentators have said, though, that he probably had as many, at least as 40,000 men. We do know from reading on ahead in this chapter that 20,000 people on the side of Absalom would be killed on the day of the battle. So he had more than 20,000. Some say he had as many as 40,000. The text describes it as all the men of Israel. That's a relative term, but it does indicate more than anything else a very, very large number of the men of Israel on Absalom's side. David sent the people out, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, "I myself will surely go out with you also." But the people said, "You should not go out, for if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us, but you're worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it's better that you be ready to help us from the city." Then the king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. The king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. It's interesting that the writer includes that bit of information. We could understand the story just as well without it, but still it does add a little bit more of detail. David didn't just take these guys aside and say, "Hey, now listen, fellas, don't do anything to Absalom for my sake." Rather, it was a public statement. It was spoken before many witnesses, and that turns out not to have mattered in the end, insofar as Joab's willingness to disobey what David had said. And then in verses 6 through 8, we find recorded in the briefest of all terms the battle and the outcome of it. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. Now, if you've looked at a map and know anything about the geography and the territory of the tribe Ephraim or Ephraim didn't have any land on the east side of the River Jordan. And so that's always been a point that some have picked out to say, well, this is not accurate. It couldn't be right because Ephraim's territory was on the western side of Jordan, and this battle obviously took place on the east side. But there was a great forest there on the east side of the Jordan River. And back in Judges chapter 12, we learn about a battle that took place where 20,000 Ephraimites, however you want to say it, were killed at the hand of Jephthah and those who were with him. And so it's thought that that forest had come to be known as the Forest of Ephraim because of that great battle that had taken place there. At any rate, it's not any kind of controversy worth getting riled up about. And then the writer says in verse 7, simply, the people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David. The slaughter there that day was great, 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Some go to this point in trying to number the army of Absalom, saying that David and his men killed 20,000, and the forest and wild animals and rough terrain and hardships and so forth took another 20,000 plus, and so Absalom's army must have been 40,000. I'm not so sure the 20,000 number there shouldn't include what David's forces killed and what the forest killed or the environment killed, but at any rate, there were a large number of people who lost their lives that day. I want you to notice how the battle unfolded. Surely Absalom and his men were marching toward where they thought David was, probably strung out in a long, spaced out, loose formation. Some commentators suggest that even very likely their weapons and their armor was loaded into wagons or carts and were being transported because they had no idea they were nearing a battle. They thought that they were going to lay siege to the city of Mahanaim, and so they were just going in that direction. And probably Absalom had by this time abandoned his chariot with the 50 young men who ran before it. And he was riding on a mule. We know that from the later reference in the chapter. And as this army of a great number of people, 20,000, 40,000, who knows, marching in a very loose, scattered formation now are suddenly set upon by three different companies of David's best soldiers. And if indeed the army of Absalom didn't even have their swords and spears and armor with them, but had to get it off of the accompanying limbers and carts, that could really explain how a lot of those folks died in an ambush rather than in a pitched battle after surrounding a city. However it happened, the army of David was victorious. Then in the next paragraph, which continues through verse 9 to verse 15, we learn of the death of the leader of the insurrection, Absalom, the king's son. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule. The mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him kept going. How many times have you heard folks say that all that long, flowing, beautiful hair of Absalom got hung up in the branches of that oak tree? Josephus was the one who started that story in his commentary remarks in some of his writings. The Bible, in every case, speaks of his head getting caught in the branches of the tree. Perhaps his head ran into the fork of two limbs or of a limb. We know that he was alive. We know that the tree caught him and his mule ran on out from under him. We know that in that state, in that condition, he was very helpless. When a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." And Joab said to the man who told him, "Now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." Listen to this. The man said to Joab, "Even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son, for in our hearing the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Protect for me the young man Absalom.' If nobody else, including Joab, was worried about doing what the king had said, what the king had ordered, this man was. He was loyal to obey David. But there was a secondary reason as well. Listen to this. "Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof." You understand what he's saying? "If I had killed him, you wouldn't have backed me up on it. You wouldn't have said a word. You would have let me be punished for disobeying the word of the king." I want you to notice that this fellow, number one, he knew and respected who the king was, but he also knew and understood Joab and how treacherous he could be. And so Joab said, "I will not waste time here with you." So he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom. The word heart there probably means the body, the central portion of the body, not so much through the organ that we know as the heart. He thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. And then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel. But Joab restrained the people. They took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in the forest and erected over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled. Now that's talking about Absalom's army. And all Israel fled, each to his tent. This note of commentary then. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar which is in the king's valley, for he said, I have no son to preserve my name. So he named the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. In the next paragraph, David finds out about the outcome. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, please let me run and bring the king news that the Lord has freed him from the hand of his enemies. Bless his heart. Ahimaaz just doesn't have any idea what's really going on here, does he? But there's something you've got to remember. Remember in the last chapter after the advice was given to Absalom by Ahithophel, and then the advice that caused him to reject Ahithophel's counsel. And immediately two young men were sent to run and tell David what was going on. Ahimaaz was one of those two young men. He was one of the covert messengers who had to, along the way, hop down in a well and hide with the something spread over the mouth of it so he wouldn't be caught by Absalom's men. And so you see, he's all caught up in this thing, and he's been right there in the forefront, and he's a secret agent. He's one of the ones who's helping this thing to unfold, and now the battle has taken place and the right side has won. And so he says, oh, let me go tell him. Let me go. Let me be the one. It's understandable why he would have that reaction. And Joab said to him, you are not the man to carry news this day, but you shall carry news another day. However, you shall carry no news today because the king's son is dead. Why do you suppose Joab didn't let Ahimaaz take the word? Well, you remember what happened to the Amalekite who so joyously came bringing word to David that his enemy Saul was dead and in fact claiming that he had killed him? David killed him. Do you remember a few chapters later, chapter 4, what happened to the two guys, the sons of Rimmon, who had killed Ish-bosheth and then couldn't wait to get back to where David was and let him know that his enemy was dead now and that they in fact had killed him? And David killed them. So Joab, being the wise man that he is, says, son, you don't need to be the one to carry the message. We've got work for you to do in the future, and you wouldn't last this one through if you're the one who takes the message. And then Joab said to the Cushite, go tell the king what you've seen. So the Cushite, an Ethiopian, bowed to Joab and ran. Now Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said once more to Joab, but whatever happens, please let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, why would you run, my son, since you will have no reward for going? But whatever happens, he said, I will run. And so he said to him, run. It seems to be just a case of the exuberance of the young man who's caught up in all of the excitement and wants to be a part of it. So Ahimaaz ran by way of the plain and passed up the Cushite. He outran him. Now David was sitting between the two gates. The watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall and raised his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running by himself. The watchman called and told the king, and the king said, if he's by himself, there is good news in his mouth. He came nearer and nearer. Then the watchman saw another man running, and the watchman called to the gatekeeper and said, "Behold, another man running by himself." And the king said, "This one also is bringing good news." The watchman said, "I think the running of the first one is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." And the king said, "This is a good man and comes with good news." Ahimaaz called and said to the king, "All is well." And he prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. And he said, "Blessed is the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who lifted their hands against my lord the king." And the king said, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And Ahimaaz answered, "When Joab sent the king's servant and your servant, I saw a great tumult, but I did not know what it was." This boy was not only speedy in his running, but he was also a liar. He knew exactly what was going on. Glance back up there at verse 20. "You're not the man to carry the news this day. You shall carry the news another day. However, you shall not carry news today because the king's son is dead." Ahimaaz knew that Absalom was dead. But he said, "Something big happened back there, but I don't know what it is. Don't know what it was." And then the king said, "Turn aside and stand here." And so he turned aside and stood still. Behold, the Cushite arrived, and the Cushite said, "Let my lord the king receive good news, for the Lord has freed you this day from the hand of all those who rose up against you." Then the king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "Let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man." In other words, it would be good if all your enemies were as dead as he is right now. The king was deeply moved, went up in the chamber above the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, "O Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. O Absalom, my son. I don't pretend to be able to understand, much less explain, all of the thought process and all of the emotional intricacies that passed through the heart of King David from the time that he received that word from Nathan back in chapter 12 regarding what would be his punishment for sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. But I am sure that on occasions just like this one that we've read of here, the mind of David must have been filled with all of those things that he had done. "If only I could have died instead of you." You remember back in chapter 12 where David grieved and mourned and lay on the ground refusing to eat as long as that little baby was sick and near the point of death. And then once that baby died, David ceased his mourning. He got up and washed his face and took nourishment. and everything kind of got back to normal. In fact, to the extent that everybody thought something was really wrong with him, and he said, "There's nothing wrong with me." While he was alive, I thought surely that there was a way, maybe, that God would spare him. But now he's died. I can't bring him back, but I can go to him. As long as Absalom was alive, David didn't seem to be all that concerned with the way Absalom was living. He banished him for 3 years and then let him come back and for 2 more years refused to speak to him. But beyond that, as long as Absalom was alive, it seems that David wasn't really all that concerned with what he was doing. And finally, when Absalom mustered his army, David gathered everything he could grab in a hurry and fled from the city, basically surrendering to the rebel Absalom. And now Absalom has been killed. And he finally begins to mourn and grieve over Absalom. What's the difference? Why is there such a difference? It's very simple. David knew that the baby was saved. David knew that Absalom was lost. How many times have we seen or have we even done, followed a similar pattern? One of the saddest things on earth is the sadness to see a parent who never gets around to grieving until it's too late. I don't pretend to be able to give anybody the convincing words that would persuade them to wake up and take a look. It's something that we all need to think about. What a waste was the life of Absalom. What a tragedy. What pain and suffering and sorrow and grief he brought into the lives of those who apparently loved him so much. And yet such is life on this earth, and especially among those who refuse to abide in God's way. Perhaps the most needful thing, observation that we could take from this chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 18, is the fact that whatever we must do, we cannot afford to lose our children. If you're subject to our Lord's invitation, we invite you to respond as we stand and sing this song.